Jester?
Here.
Scott Holwick is not here yet. Roger Lane?
Here.
Renee Davis?
Here.
Ken Houston?
Here.
Wes Lowery?
Here.
Kevin Bogan?
Here.
Jason Elkins?
Here.
Danielle Cassidy?
There you go.
Bryce Hadley?
Here.
Chris Huffer?
Here.
And Councilmember Martin?
Here.
And this is Randy Hershey is the staff member as well.
First of all, Renee, welcome back.
Yeah.
I'm excited to be back.
You missed us all.
I know, I'm a happy nerd. Like, I was like, woo!
Well, we're happy to have you back.
Excited to be here.
Yeah, okay. Let's start with approval of previous month's minutes. Any comments or questions about last meeting's minutes from anybody? Or a motion to accept them?
Absolutely.
Okay, Allison, second, Al. Very good.
You vote?
Yeah, all in favor, say aye. Opposed?
I'm abstaining.
Thank you, yeah. Okay, how about the water status report?
I'll do that this morning.
All right.
The flow in the St. Rain at lines this morning was 15 CFS, and the historical average is also 15 CFS for the state. The call on St. Rain this morning is Highland number 2, and that's a 1881 call. Call on the main stem of the South Platte River was Pruitt World War with an admin of 26302, and that's a priority date of 1922. Ralph Price Reservoir was at an elevation of 6391.6, approximately 14,036 acre feet, which is down approximately, that's 14,000 acre feet, which is down approximately 1,800 acre feet from full. Union Reservoir was at an elevation of 24 feet, or 10,232 acre feet, which is down approximately 2,450 acre feet. And currently, the St. Rain Basin storage is at 69%.
You know, off the top of your head, capacity-wise, like rough, right, what percent is it of capacity? Is that a number that pops in your head at all?
It doesn't pop in my head, but
it's a little under 90%.
90?
Yeah, because the capacity is 16,197.2 acre feet. We're now about 1,800, so a little over, we're probably about 88%.
Would that be similar to McIntosh?
Similar in how much it's down.
I got Union, I'm sorry.
It's similar in how much it's down, or similar in percentage? So, let's see, Union's about just under 13,000, and we were at 10. So Union, percentage-wise, is probably down, down to the, so we're closer to 20%.
Down? 8%, yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Union, and it's because Union is just so much flatter and shallower, and Flat Rock's so much cheaper.
Okay. All right.
Wes, that was scary.
I was impressed.
Any questions for Kevin? All right, thanks, Kevin. Public invited here?
None.
None? All right. Any agenda revisions? Okay. All right, let's get into development activity. Who's gonna take that?
I will. So there's three specific development activities that run, only one of which is requiring board action. That's the first one, Boston Sunset Apartments final plat. So Boston, Boston Station Apartments final plat. That's roughly a 12-acre parcel. It's down off of, kind of in between Boston Street and First Avenue. It happens to include two different annexations. So you have the original town annexation, and then also the Turkey Plant Addition annexation. So usually when plats come through, they're all part of one annexation. This particular one is two annexations. So that which was part of the original town annexation, because it predated Longmont Water Board, there's no further water requirements due on that area. And that which is on the south, which was part of the Turkey Plant addition, when that annexed, there was no historical water rights, and there's not been anything satisfied. So therefore, it has 3 acre foot per acre. So looked at it as a whole, Boston Station Apartments final plat has a 26.01 acre foot deficit, and it will be in compliance with satisfaction of that deficit. And so what they're looking to put there is, I think it's around 12 multifamily buildings with about 367 market rate apartments. So if you have any questions on that one.
What was the number of them?
367. So just some units are going to have more, like 40 or more, and others less than 40, but about 40 per building.
And I assume they're doing cash and Luda.
So there, I think so. There might be, they're entertaining the idea of trying to find some non-historic. So that's good. This particular one might not be satisfied until later this year, but the group that is developing this develops all over the country, and they specialize in apartments. And so if they can find some non-historic water and hold it until they're ready to satisfy everything, they will. But they haven't decided for sure how they're going to assess it.
You know, just for my information, you talk about direct flow requirement and storage requirement. We always kind of get that combination between the two in these developments, or some just swing to one or the other?
So I think I understand your question. So typically, a development, when it comes through as annexation, when they bring their historic water, it'll typically satisfy a majority of the direct flow component, that being the 2 acre foot per acre, and sometimes a little bit of the storage. In this one, in this case, it's, you kind of got the opposite end of both spectrums. You got one part of this that has no further deficits, and the other one's got 3 acre feet per acre, where, let's just say, a typical plat would normally have 1 or 1.5 acre foot per acre over the entire plat. So this hybrid here, so if your question is, what do they normally bring in historic, usually it satisfies a significant portion of the direct flow, maybe a minority portion of the storage, but with each annexation being unique, it's all over the board, from not having none to even having some fully satisfied. We've had some annexation that have brought their historic water, and when applied, it satisfied the full 3 acre foot per acre. So really all the way up across the board.
Any other questions about this proposal? Yeah, go ahead.
Isn't really water supply needed? Those little gravel pits in the south?
So say that again.
Is there a little gravel pit to the south? I'm just curious
what. To the south. So the, right.
I swear. This is a part of the Dickens Farm Park, so south of Boston Avenue is owned by the city.
Okay.
And it's a park.
Do you have any stormwater concerns with what? I mean, I assume that's, you know, paved, not a lot of parking spaces for that many people. Now, is that going to run up in there and be an issue?
I would be surprised if they're storming. Chris, do you have any idea?
Yes. So I'm Chris Upper with Public Works. So there are drainage issues with this site, mostly due to the fact that there are sanitary sewer trunk mains that run east-west on the north side of Boston Avenue, which is interfering with their ability to get storm drainage off their site. The site typically flows from north to south. Today, it's all flowing over. As they try to put in ponds and water quality features, those sorts of things, having to dig down, they're running into those interceptors. The interceptors are about 4 feet deep, and one of them is 36 inch, and the other 30 inch height. So So they're significant pipes to get around. So they're working on proposals for the drainage.
So does the city not have as-built maps for that subsurface infrastructure?
Oh, yes, they're...
So they knew that it was there?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
Staff has been working with them for quite some time on that.
Okay.
So one option that they are looking into is to try and drain to that pond, but there's several issues with that, and we prefer that not be the case. But one option is also to go directly east through the fire training center. So they're evaluating that at this time.
Thank you.
Any other comments?
I was just going to say, it didn't seem like there was any like affordable housing.
No more than what's going to be standard requirement.
Yeah, that, I guess, so that wasn't included in the rundown.
Right, yeah. We've not, usually we'd only include it if they're looking for an exceptional, above and beyond minimum. So,
yeah.
So therefore, this isn't like what we've seen when we did the one by the Costco.
Like Costco,
right,
yeah.
This isn't the same kind of thing.
And that was because?
They went, well, for one, so there was a city... an economic development incentive, and then there was also the affordable housing incentive. This, what they're proposing here, doesn't trigger that. They haven't got to that level.
And so that was our last, maybe my last experience with some of this. And so, but that's not necessarily typical. We're back to kind of like your run-of-the-mill
development. That's exactly correct. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. In fact, right now with the economics of land prices and building materials. A lot of projects that have been planning to build affordable units are paying fees to do because they can't meet the price on the market rate.
Yeah.
So we're actually losing the expectation of builders providing affordable units right now.
Yeah. You know, to that point, Mark, are they given the option to supply money to build affordable on another site? Is that an option we give them?
They can pay the fee in lieu, which goes into the Affordable Housing Fund. They can donate land. They can build affordable units on another site that is less costly, although I don't know if we've ever had anybody do that. But the fee in lieu is essentially that, to pay money.
And we tend to encourage them one way or the other, or is it their option?
It was intended to be their option. Now, it has not been rebalanced in a while. It should have been rebalanced after 3 years, and we're in the middle of a pandemic, so I can forget, but I don't think we did that.
Okay.
We were also, you know, Karen Rooney was leaving, Molly was coming on, so I think that will probably come up this summer before the budgeting cycle begins.
Okay, is there a motion on this project?
I can't, so because it's, so at this stage we just, what is our obligation?
Before a recommendation to City Council on that this is the, that these are the deficits and that you concur with.
Just the calculus of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I
so moved. All right. Second?
So the other two that were in front of you.
We got to vote on.
Oh, sorry, you haven't approved it yet.
all in favor? Aye.
So the other two in front of you are for information that Domi Town owns final subdivision plat. The reason this one is for information, it's already in compliance, so there's really nothing further for you to act on, but it is a roughly an 8-acre parcel located south of Kimprat Boulevard. This one's for 96 townhomes in a mixed use area, and I think there's like 16 rows of townhomes on this one, but it's in compliance, so that's why that one doesn't need your action. The other one that we have is Springs at Longmont Final Plat. And the reason this one is in front of you, there was a change in the acreage, the requirement acreage, therefore changed. So it's been updated to reflect that. But it was for 10 buildings of a total of 212 multifamily units. And so, again, we're just bringing that in front just to correct that. That's like changing an area.
Is that going to fill up most of that vacant area? That's the, it's just west of Walmart, isn't it?
Just south of Walmart, that's right. Yeah, there's
or south Walmart, I know.
Yeah. Okay. So there's, yeah, this isn't what we'll call, some people would refer to kind of what's the period up now. This is, if you exercised out, if you left Walmart, there's already some houses or some condo units that are there. This is on behind those, you really wouldn't.
I don't know what that street is that runs south of Walmart, but anyway, it's south of that street then.
Yeah, yep.
Well, I know.
I think it's Lincoln Drive. I think
the street, Little Street is.
Is it Lincoln Drive?
Or whatever it is.
It doesn't show there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's Lincoln's up on the top. Anyway, so that was just for informational purposes.
Okay. Any other comments or what? All right, I guess this is yours also, was the posting place?
Yes, so each year we're required to designate a specific location where the public can go and find board meeting notices. Since we didn't have a meeting in January, we're doing that now. And so the city attorney's office has recommended that we designate the public portal on the city's webpage and website as the primary location of its official posting place for monthly live board meetings, and the service center lobby as the backup location. And so that would be staff's recommendation. And that's what it was last year, and we're recommending just continuing with that. So, but we needed an affirmative action to establish the posting place.
Questions for us? I'd like to make a motion to accept staff's recommendation.
Sure, I'd like a motion to approve the suggested public posting places.
Second. So, all in favor?
Aye.
So that'll be, that's it on this.
That's right.
Don't see this coming back again.
It'll come back next January.
So really? Annually?
Annually, okay. We have to do this.
Okay. Danielle, you down there?
I'm here.
I guess, let me ask a question to the board members. Was everybody able to access these sites to look at management plan?
Yes, it took me a while to figure out that it was in my junk folder, but which it said. It said very clearly, it's in your junk folder. And I'm like, oh, okay, the access portal thing. And I'm like, oh, yeah, okay.
Everybody get through it?
My junk folder didn't catch it, so yeah. It was like in my real life.
Okay, well, it's pretty voluminous, as you know, Danielle. How do you want to go about educating us on what
I want to, so what I think we have is everybody's had a chance to look at the document, but people have been on water board for various lengths of time and so have had various exposure to this project. That is why I put together this PowerPoint, which I'll go through rather quickly, keeping in mind that I'm talking to people who may know a lot of this already, picked up a lot of this in the document, but I kind of want to set the scene for people who haven't been sitting here since 2019 when this project kicked off, because I presented this at Parks and Rec Advisory Board, and it was the same situation. Some people that were brand new to the board didn't have the context that some other people had. So
okay.
I acknowledge that there are a lot of slides. There are 40 slides, but I've divided it up. I'll go through it quickly.
And then we can talk about it and you can ask your questions. That's okay. That's how I'd like to handle it.
That's
is there a remote or something I can flip through my slides? Can I bring that down?
Yep.
Is that
Chimney Hollow asphalt you've got there?
It is, yeah. Send that around. That's exactly.
Okay. Oh, what did I do? Okay, so this, again, lots of slides. These numbers are a little off because I keep fussing with this presentation, but 40 slides. And I try to divide it logically out into the way that the document was presented to you. Why did we do this plan? How did we develop this plan? What methods went into collecting the data? Because there was scientific data, visitor use data, and public engagement. And then we'll talk about some results, and then we'll talk about what we recommend. Okay. So first, where is Button Rock? This group knows where Button Rock is. Here it is. It's in the foothills west of Lyons. Here's the city of Longmont. This is the map that you see currently in the kiosk when you go to Button Rock, and it gives you a good sense of the preserved boundary. There is the white, but then you see that a lot of the surrounding land is other public land. A lot of it is Forest Service. In the south and southeast, you see some Boulder County land, and then you've got some private land, some residences that access their properties through the gate. Button Rock is the only preserve that Longmont has in its system. We have open spaces, natural areas, parks, but this is the only preserve. 2,671 acres managed for water storage and the ecology of the surrounding acreage. Throughout this has been a four-year process, and one important piece is that we developed a purpose statement for Button Rock Preserve, which we hope to codify in code as this document process is accepted. This is the only slide I actually do want to read to you, so here we go. To protect, preserve, restore, and sustain Button Rock Preserve's municipal drinking water storage and supply, native ecosystems, wildlife habitat, and cultural resources in perpetuity. To support preserve management and enhance the ecological function of Button Rock Preserve's natural systems, as well as the greater St. Vrain Creek watershed in which it presides. And to prescribe areas suitable for passive use in addition to areas closed for resource protection, facility protection, or public safety. So keep that in mind as we go through the rest, because it informs everything else in the document in the presentation. There are a lot of guiding documents that went into this plan, including Vision Longmont, including City Council's work plan, including City Council's 2019 climate emergency, the 2018 open space plan, the 2019 wildlife management plan. All of those were resources that underpin the forestry stewardship plan for Button Rock. They all underpin this plan, even though this is the first management plan that we have for Button Rock. And this slide is important because it's reminding you that climate change is a driver of biodiversity, and biodiversity is one of the solutions to climate change. So why are we doing this plan now? Again, these are questions to keep in mind as we go through the rest of the presentation. How did we develop this plan? We worked with a lot of different agencies. We had a technical advisory committee, so it wasn't just staff working on this alone. We worked with Parks and Wildlife, State Forest Service, U.S. Forest Service, Boulder County, Left Hand Watershed Center, Lyons, the town of Lyons, and then we had various consultants helping us on data collection as well. The public was very involved throughout this process. We have had and have a website called Caring for Button Rock, where the public could go if they missed a public meeting and see what happened and read other people's comments, make their own comments. And then we've come and updated three boards throughout this process: the Water Board, the Parks and Recreation Advisory Board, and the Sustainability Board. And when we are done, that'll be 5 visits to each board and 8 visits to City Council with interim updates and then our final presentation. This is just a little bit of the timeline. Like many projects of the city, we got a little waylaid by the pandemic. So normally we don't take this long on a management plan, but here we are. Okay, so some of the methods that went into this plan. So we developed goals. In the document, you'll see 10 goals. Here you'll see three of the most critical goals, and you'll see this upside-down triangle. The purpose of Button Rock is to protect the water quality, the delivery, storage, and infrastructure, but also conserve the biodiversity of the greater preserve. And then also a promise to our residents to keep it open for passive recreation, as long as goals 1 and 2 are not adversely affected. So this is just a kind of a visual for that. Scientific data collection, botany and zoology was done in these categories here, hydrology was done in these categories here. Other baseline data, scientific data collected, roads and trails, so mapping, science inventory was completed, cultural resource documentation was done, and infrastructure was looked at throughout the preserve. And then we looked at visitor use, the visitation, rules. Rules haven't been significantly updated at our preserve since the 1990s, but things have changed a lot at the preserve since the 1990s, so we took a look at that. Staffing, and then impacts of the different types of recreation that are allowed at Button Rock. Another type of method that we used on this project was literature review. This is an excerpt of the literature that we reviewed specifically on domestic dogs in nature areas. Okay, and then part 4, so now we're getting into results. And first I'm gonna talk about the results we found in the visitor use category. And then I'm gonna get into, we engaged the public. What did we learn from the public engagement and what were some of the comments? And so first of all, here's a timeline I made for people who haven't been here this whole time, with this 4 years that this has been going on. So in the 80s and 90s, the city of Longmont developed a formal trail system because we were starting to see higher recreational use at Button Rock, and so it formalizing the trails. And then in the early 1990s, the way we handled allowing passive recreation at the preserve is over time we slowly added more uses. So for example, rock climbing came in, and then maybe fishing, and then maybe dog walking was allowed. So it wasn't we opened in 1965 and everything happened all at the same time. It was kind of an iterative thing that came about. And then in 2011, we saw a kind of a jump in visitor numbers, and we'll look at that in a future slide. The flood happened in 2013, and these are the words of our former watershed ranger at Button Rock, Jamie Friel, social media advertising the preserve. It was something significant that he noticed, that although it's not advertised everywhere, everybody was learning about the preserve because of social media. In 2018, the staff came to Water Board and Council and proposed changes to the domestic dog policy at Button Rock Preserve. At the time, nothing was changed, but then with what was being proposed in terms of dog leashing. But then in 2019, you know, that was a bit of a catalyst to this management plan process being kicked off. And when we kicked it off and introduced it to council, city council then put in place the interim dog visitation policy that we currently have, which is if you visit Button Rock with a dog, you have to have one dog per person on a leash with a dog pickup bag. And that's what's been in place since 2019. First with educational enforcement for a time after, and then after that, just straight ranger enforcement. And now here we are in 2023, we're down there at the second to the bottom, presenting the draft plan to the boards, and then next month we'll be presenting it to city council. So you are the third of three boards. So now back to some of the visitor use results. This is what you see in the left box there is a mixture of what we found from the public survey. So we surveyed demographics each time we surveyed. Three out of four surveys, we looked at demographics, and we found that roughly 65-74% of the people that visit the preserve are from a Longmont zip code. And then here on the right, you see visitor numbers over time. And these are all ranger qualitative estimates of visitors until you get to 2018. Then we started using automated counters, and that's when we also started taking data in on cars as well. So cars suddenly show up there in 2018. 2022, something went wrong with our counters, so we don't have good full year data for that, so it's not shown here. And then the upper left is just a graphic of what that looks like. The cars are there in orange. Okay, so now we're getting into public engagement, some of the results of our surveys. So in this first survey, there are four surveys, 426 people participated, 45% of people bring a dog. Most people come to the preserve to hike, and most people visit multiple times per year. In survey two, 67% bring 1 to 2 people. So 983 people responded to this survey. 60% would still visit the preserve if there were a fee. 70% understand that it is Longmont's primary source of drinking water. 82% agree that prescribed fire is an important management tool. And 81% prefer to encounter fewer than 25 people. And then in the comments, the majority of comments were saying, if we were to add amenities, what do you want? And people were saying restrooms and trash, or trash cans. Survey three, 831 participants. Most people disagreed with eliminating the fishing permit, something considered during this planning process. And then if there were a fee charged, most people support a weekend daily vehicle pass. And most people agree with a fee during the busy summer months. This is the same survey here. We saw 131 written comments, and those listed there in the middle are the categories that the comments are in. Most comments were about dogs, and then hiking, then fees. And most people would not ride a shuttle, but this survey was conducted at the very beginning of the COVID pandemic in April and May. So if we were gonna think about that further or collect more data, we may wanna redo that survey just because of the timing that was done. And most people surveyed here disagree with the no dog recommendation from staff. Public survey number four focused on code updates to the Button Rock code. So the purpose that we read at the beginning, we were recommending that we codify that in the code because there's nothing written about the purpose of the preserve in the code. And then these are some of the other recommendations. And what you're reading here is that of all the recommendations made, the public felt fine about all of them except the dog recommendation. In general, the majority of people said they disagree with a prohibition on dogs. And now into the scientific results. So the botany and zoology, and I'm not going to get into all this detail, but the point of this slide is that what we have is an incredibly diverse preserve in terms of native plants, rare plants, native wildlife, and across many categories, amphibians, bats and other mammals, even insects, which were observed but not, you know, quantitated in this, it wasn't part of the baseline data, but. So the botany and zoology showed us just what an incredible preserve we have in terms of biodiversity. And now looking into the literature and from what we know as professionals in the field, dogs in a preserve, in a protected preserve, do have an immediate impact on ecosystems and wildlife. And these are some of the impacts that dogs have. One particular study that was done in Hall Ranch, which is adjacent to Button Rock, is something that we highlighted here because it was interesting. It shows the effect of dogs, whether they're on or off leash, and the effect that they have when a person and a dog on or off leash are on a trail on these different species. And these are local species. All these species that were looked at in Hall Ranch also exist in Button Rock Preserve. So you can just see the area of influence with dogs are the dotted lines is greater. If a person is walking up that trail and there are mule deer nearby, then their travel path is going to be changed.
Can I ask you a quick question? Did you say all these dog comments, are these dogs leashed or unleashed? I mean,
they looked at both dogs on and off leash, and this is a combined result.
Okay.
So this is not Button Rock then?
This is at Hall Ranch. This is a study that was done at Hall Ranch in 2008. We worked with river restoration consultants and they collected hydrology data for us. So they went and they looked and they mapped out all the drainage basins at Button Rock Preserve. So all those drainage basins, you know, draining into the North St. Vrain Creek and the Ralph Price Reservoir and the Longmont Reservoir that we have there in the middle of our preserve. So this graphic just kind of shows you that it's all connected.
Danielle, on that previous slide, was that in meters or miles?
I'm going to go with that. Meters. You're talking about the dog?
Meters.
You know, and if you, like, when I put slide numbers on here, so we can go back to things. So you're looking at impact on either side of a trail. So, like, mule deer are really affected. 100 meters on either side of the trail. Dogs also leave waste behind, and some of it gets picked up, and some of it gets half picked up, and some of it doesn't get picked up. And that has an immediate impact on the water and the soil and the biodiversity of the preserve. Here are some of the impacts. Recommendations. These are recommendations from staff after all this data has been collected and you know, in conjunction with our technical advisory committee of all of those agencies that we worked with to put this plan together. Colorado Parks and Wildlife, Boulder County, Town of Lyons, etc. So we do recommend implementing a no dog policy at Button Rock Preserve, because like I said, it's our only preserve. And while this data doesn't necessarily show, okay, we can point to an acute problem and I can give you that this equals this. We know that we have significant diversity in our preserve. We know we have incredible resources that we're trying to protect. So, you know, doing nothing, staff feels, is not a good way forward given present day circumstances and with visitor use the way it is today. Also on this slide is just some data from the last couple of years in terms of ranger contacts at the preserve. The most significant amount of contacts happened for dog violations. Dogs off leash, more than one dog. In 2018, 2021, 210 ranger contacts for dog violations and 151 in 2022. Also, good neighbor, not something I've talked about yet, but we are adjacent to Boulder County, and they Hall Ranch designed their trails, so the trail that is connected to Button Rock Preserve that goes back and forth, they do not allow bikes on that trail. We do allow bikes in Hall Ranch, but not on that trail because we don't have bikes in the preserve. So they worked with us on that planning effort to make sure that worked for us. But since we allow dogs, we do sometimes have dogs going into Hall Ranch. So they've, in the intervening years, put up signs at the various forest border places to say, you know, you're entering Hall Ranch, there's a dog prohibition here. Something that I have heard is that there aren't a lot of other places to take your dog. And so this is just some of the other places that you can take your dog. If you remember in the beginning, we're surrounded by U.S. Forest Service land at the preserve, and U.S. Forest Service allows dogs in most places. And then, you know, City of Longmont has lots of places. We have another we've got our 2,600 acre preserve, but we've got another 2,400 acres of parks and open spaces and natural areas where dogs are allowed. And we've got 6 dog parks allowed.
That don't feed our drinking water.
Yeah. And another recommendation that is coming out of this plan is dividing the preserve into management zones. Now that we have all this really important botany and zoology data, it's kind of clear how the preserve could be divided into management zones. So you can see up here in the upper left with the checkered, that would be a seasonal closure for elk, but you know, the rest of the year when it's not seasonally closed for elk, it would be part of zone 3, natural areas. This is a habitat conservation area where there are quite a few important resources, and so keeping this area closed for biodiversity protection is a recommendation. So management zones. And then a lot of management actions came out of this plan, as you got to the end there, some of those tables at the end of the document. And then we recommended a level of importance and a timeline for these. So short-term, mid-term, long-term, or something that would be ongoing. And then they're divided into the categories you saw in the plan. So for example, we do have water sampling points that are going on up there. We want to continue to collect that data. It's going to be more useful in the midterm, which is, you know, 5 years plus, as we get more years of data in a row. This is a very important piece of data that we want to continue to collect and work with the water quality lab on, Longmont's water quality lab.
Item one, planning to add raw water supply. Can you be a little more specific? What are the thoughts about that?
So do you recall in the document we showed a figure of just the research that has been done on the expansion of Ralph Price Reservoir in the future? It's something that's off in the distant future, but we did look at what it would look like, what would the footprint look like, and so now we can see it. We can see it in terms of, you know, where we've put our management zones and where that would be in terms of existing infrastructure, trails, and things like that. And Ken, you can say more.
So it's an expansion.
It would be an expansion, yeah. It would allow Button Rock Preserve to be a place where we could have increased capacity for storage, water storage. Almost done. These are just the other categories that we put things in terms of a timeline and priority list. And code updates. we want the Button Rock section of code to stand on its own. We want people to be able to go there and understand all the rules and regulations of that apply to Button Rock, and we want them to be updated to align with the present day uses that we're seeing at Button Rock. And here in the corner, I've started to populate this box with the results that we're seeing from our three boards. So Parks and Rec Advisory Board voted 5-1 to accept this plan and to recommend it to council, but they also acknowledge that they are split on the issue of the dog recommendation. Sustainability Board voted 5-1 to accept the plan and recommend it to council. And this is the end.
Yeah, I've got this dog thing seems to be pretty controversial. Does Boulder County allow dogs in any of their areas? Or
they allow dogs in most of their areas. Actually, they don't allow dogs at, I believe it's called Dog Lake, Caribou Ranch, Hall, and Heil Ranch. So in 2006, after doing 7 years of work and study, they proposed and then adopted a dog moratorium at Hall and Heil Ranch. And so those are the four places that just no dogs are allowed. Leash dogs are allowed at some places. Some places are split where you have to have, dogs can be on certain trails, dogs can be off leash on certain trails. I don't really know all the details. I really know where they have a dog moratorium.
And the Forest Service, what's there?
The Forest Service and BLM are kind of in one category in terms of how their philosophy in terms of recreation and where dogs can be. And then I would say National Park Service and U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service are in a different category. Those are in a conservation versus a recreation focus. So if you're going to go to Rocky Mountain National Park, dogs are allowed in kind of very developed areas, parking lots, where people are, their cars and things like that. And that's about it. They don't want dogs out on the alpine tundra and things like that. But Forest Service, almost every single trail, dogs are allowed. You know, and recreation is the focus.
Martin?
Yeah, I'm wondering in the places where dogs are allowed versus not allowed outside Button Rock, do their rules take into account the contribution to the watershed?
I am not sure I'm able to answer that one. I think it depends, right? It depends on the organization and which place you're talking about and if it's part of a watershed. I mean, yeah, it's some watersheds, like Boulder's watershed, no dogs. It's the watershed.
So Boulder takes that into account. We're not sure about the Forest Service and stuff.
Yeah.
I would just point out, too, that the Silver Lake Drainage, managed by the city of Boulder, it's not just no dogs, it's no people. No recreation, no public access at all. You're thinking about the area beyond the Rainbow Lakes trailhead. So as Danielle pointed out, there's a spectrum of how watershed protection is approached by land management agencies. Again, Danielle pointed out the conservation ethic of the National Park Service. They don't allow dogs at all. You have the kind of on that end, no public access at all in Silver Lake Drainage, kind of everywhere in between. With the USDA Forest Service generally allowing dogs off leash. However, they also have wilderness areas where dogs are required generally to be on leash. And they sometimes have buffers for camping and things like that around lakes in their wilderness areas and recreation areas. So there's a spectrum across the country in terms of how these resources are managed.
Well, I mean, just looking at the plan and I kind of hold my most of the comments, I guess, to the end is I really like that you're prioritizing in the plan that it is a water resources preserve, not a recreation facility. I think that that's something that gets lost. A lot of people are like, hey, I'm going to go recreate. And it's like, cool, but that's not the primary purpose here. So thank you for prioritizing that. I think that's huge. Because I think it contextualizes what we're asking for when we do ask for, dog limitations or no dogs, or to pick up your food. You know, it's pretty basic, but it ties it in. So thank you for that. I was also kind of interested to see that the visitor counts are just up. Like, they were nuts in 2020, but so is everything else. But they've been, you know, half nuts, like, for 5 or 10 years now. There was a, and then a step up in the spike in 2020. But it's, and it hasn't really gone down. Like, it looked like it went down, but it went down to the original thing that kind of got everybody nervous. And I think that's important, too. In your recommendations, did you include a recommendation to charge?
So we surveyed the public about that.
I was delighted to see there was public support for it during high times. I was like, that's great.
But we didn't make a recommendation at this time because we feel that we want to further study that. We dived in, and you can go into the appendices and really see the question we specifically asked. Because we really dug in and said, like, if it's a pass, what kind of pass?
Yeah.
You know, on what days? And we presented that here, but it's not something that we're ready to recommend at this time. We think with management zones, a dog prohibition, and the code updates, and the, you know, codifying the purpose and the rest of the code updates for present day, that these will be really effective tools. But we also acknowledge that this is an adaptive plan, right? And it's just based on today's best science. And so if more science comes in, and as we continue to do the studies that we're recommending, the further studies, the more pointed studies, we wanna go in and be able to update the plan.
I'm gonna harp on the fees just a little longer, because I actually was really keen to see public support for it. And I also know that if we're spending staff time, and by we, I'm gonna talk about people in Longmont who are paying utility bills, and, you know, that sort of thing. That's supporting staff time to deal with public, and when people outside the community come in and also create a need for that staff time, I'm very comfortable asking them to help pay for it. You know, it's kind of one of those things of pay for what you use. And so I still think it's pretty cool. I did like, you know, that there was an element in the plan where it was, you know, if you have a utility bill, you get one rate, and if you can't provide a utility bill, you get a higher rate. And that's kind of one of those things that I was kind of digging that too. Yeah.
And to your point, which is definitely insightful, I appreciate you looking over the plan. One of the policies that we surveyed the public about was rescinding the rough price fishing permit. Ultimately, the public disagreed with rescinding that, but it's something that we researched. That is a fee that we do have in place for fishing on rough price during a specified season. And we have two fee rates for utility and non-utility customers, so just wanted to speak to that.
So that's already in place?
Well, yes, specifically for
just for fishing.
Yeah.
Correct. Yep, okay. And has been for some time.
So that's kind of awesome, because it's like you're trying it out. And I guess part of the reason I also see fee is I could see fee reducing people counts, because, you know, dogs are an issue in terms of dog waste. Dogs are an issue in terms of wildlife interaction. But to be honest with you, people are an issue too. I mean, there's waste of various sorts of people. And then, of course, my fear from a water resources perspective is fire. And, you know, I know there's no camping, there's no open fires up there. But, you know, people can't follow the dog rule. Just fewer people, fewer fires is kind of
the line. Well, I mean, I've looked at a lot of pictures, and I ran into people's fire pits and things like that. You know?
And that's scary, you know? That's scary. The effect of fire on a watershed is just...
First of all, I'll reiterate a few of the things that Renee said. I think the dog recommendation seems to make a lot of sense, specifically because you so nicely outlined the hierarchy of priority for the space, right? So that it is a water preserve first, a biodiversity preserve second, recreational opportunity is somewhere on the list as well, but we really need to kind of like prioritize those first two things above and beyond everything else. And it makes a lot of sense to me that you know, dogs are not necessarily the best situation to prioritize those first two things. So I had a question about the fishing. So the issue here is whether or not to rescind the special permit.
Correct.
For fishing.
Correct.
There.
There's still a state. You have to carry the state license with you no matter what.
So and it's not the issue of like whether to not like a prohibition on fishing. Or something.
No, the question that was asked to the public was, you know, because we were seeing, especially with our former watershed ranger, it was selling the permits and working on the permits, you know, and if we offered 600 permits and they weren't selling out every year, do we need the permits? And we asked the public, do you think, you know, we need the permits? And we actually did sell out during the pandemic, you know, and the public clearly said, yes, why would you get rid of this? Okay. You know, this is, we're trying to, you know, control, like, you know, look at recreation. Why would we take something away? And if you take something away like that, it's going to be hard to reinstate.
Right. So I'm just curious about, like, there'd be two purposes, or potentially a couple of purposes for the permitting. Number one, of course, would be kind of like a quota system, making sure that it's not being overused or overfished. The other, though, is like a source of revenue, perhaps. Is the extra fee and permit system a source of revenue that somehow does something for
permit fee amount was set originally when we. When Rob Price Reservoir was not open officially.
Okay.
It was just a stream of alcohol. When we opened in the early 1990s, Ralph Price Reservoir to fishing, there were two concerns. One is, we just get into the, enclosed for 30 years, and there's monster fish in there. Turns out there wasn't, but that's okay. So there's a concern it would be too much pressure, too many people.
Yeah.
And then, so the fishing permit fee was set to cover the cost of administering the permit fee. So really, yes, we do get some money, but basically that's what it costs us to check the licenses and run the program, and it really isn't done to generate any revenue at all.
But we still have a cap on licenses.
We do. 600. We originally were at 500. We always sold out 500. We moved it to 600, and then for years, number of years, we didn't sell all 600. We did during the pandemic portion because you couldn't go anywhere else to fish. Everywhere was closed. Now, lately, if we sell out, I think it's pretty late in the season.
2021, we came very, very close, and then it hasn't been as close. It wasn't as close in 2022. I think we, anecdotally, off the top of my head, I'd say high 400s in 2022, 2021, it was pretty close to selling out. We switched over to online sales, which reduced the ranger staff time involved in administering at least the sale of permits. We're very strict about checking permits, both state licenses and city permits. And as the pandemic eased, we switched back over where we have online sales. We also do in-person sales and phone sales, which is helpful for people who don't have access to the internet or is not currently as familiar with how to access the city's recreation website.
We considered in the late 1990s, early 2000s, to eliminate the permit system and just lock it. A lot of outreach got the exact same result. No, we want you to keep selling permits and keep it closed.
Well, I mean, from a fishing perspective, you probably don't want to be out there elbow to elbow with 1,000 people either. So, like, making sure that, you know, if you're able to get one of the permits, of course, then you know that it'll be not as busy as perhaps other places.
Yeah. You know, just a curiosity question, do we allow boats?
Not contact with water. Technically, some people step in the water. Now we do allow
people who are fishing to be in the water, in the stream.
Waiting, specifically, is
for the purpose of fishing.
Yeah. But you can't go out and fish off dinner too.
I can't, no, when I go out snowing. Very particular about that. Is there anything? I wouldn't see.
It's like, it's definitely the most strictly enforced from a ranger statistic perspective. It's the most strictly enforced regulation. Is the prohibition on swimming and water contact, as well as prohibition on boating. The one exemption in the, or exception in the municipal code is we do permit, if someone were to kayak down North St. Vrain from Allen's Park, to continue in a continuous downstream fashion through the reservoir, which I understand was more popular prior to the 2013 flood, it's extremely, and it's professional level and beyond difficulty, whitewater upstream of the reservoir. So I've been working as a ranger for the city since 2020. I get to see anybody kayak down the North St. Vrain, and I'm friends with some high-level whitewater folks, and it seems that it's just not very popular anymore. But we do allow for that, so people can portage the dams and continue downstream. They can't put on the water in the reservoir, except for our trailhead and continue downstream from the parking lot. So essentially no boating is allowed.
Allison, do you have any comments?
I was curious, the other boards, it looks like it was a 5-1 decision in terms of recommendations.
Yeah, we'll go back and we'll see that again.
Just curious as to the one, the sensible.
On sustainability board, the person who dissented did not make any comments, so I'm not sure if he didn't make any comments. The person who dissented on Parks and Recreation board did make some comments. And he's said that he's heard a lot from public talking to him and saying that, you know, it would be a tragedy to not allow dogs on Button Rock. And they love having their dogs there and they don't want that taken away. So he was really trying to be an advocate for those voices.
And then two other of the folks felt the same way.
The three that were split, so there were two people in Parks and Rec Advisory Board that were kind of in that, trying to play the, you know, advocate role for saying that we've heard a lot from the public saying they want their dogs there, that they don't want anything to change. And then the third person said he has two dogs, but he understands looking at the rules and regulations and the present day circumstances, and that the interim rule made sense to him, and what he did was he just adapted. But when it came to putting together the language for their vote, they wanted to have that piece in there, and when it, about the dog, and when it came to that part, he voted with the two that were bringing up the public wanting dogs there. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. How does that vote work then? So they accepted the plan, but part of the plan is to the moratorium on dogs. So they carved out that piece of the plan and they voted on it separately.
Three of them did.
Okay. Well, I mean, six of them did because theoretically it was 3-2-3, I guess. Or right. There was a lot of talk about how does this work. Yeah. Okay.
And you know, they had a difficult time wording their quote, and so, you know, if I didn't give a good detailed summary, of course the recording is available and you can watch them. They were on the 13th. Have their discussion.
And if I could maybe characterize it, I hope to characterize it well. They had an earlier vote about the dog, and that's whether or not to. Three wanted to prohibit dogs, three wanted to not. So they couldn't come up with a recommendation on that aspect of the plan. Then they considered the whole plan. And obviously two of them who had voted as they did felt, even though maybe they didn't get a recommendation on that particular part of the plan. Overall, they approved the plan.
With the dog restriction.
With the dog restriction, as a recommendation.
I mean, you know, it's not unusual, I would think. I mean, their purview, of course, is kind of a recreational purview, right? And dogs presumably are a part of that.
Well, they even debated that, actually.
Okay, interesting.
And not all of them felt that way.
Okay. Yeah. Well, yeah. And, yeah, presumably three of them made some assessment that dogs maybe weren't part of that equation. I think it's interesting that the sustainability group voted a bit more in favor without the kind of dog stipulation. I think Water Board has a kind of a similar purview, let's say, of sustainability. I mean, of course, we have a different focus, but it's a more environmentally and resources focus area rather than that kind of.
Marcia, you got a comment?
Yeah, just to get back to Allison's question. And Heather, you may know whether it was this person or not. There was one person on the Sustainability Advisory Board who opposes all regulation.
It wasn't that person.
Interesting.
You know, I'll just tell you my preference. Rather than us sit here and debate dog or no dog, I would prefer either you approve the plan or you do not approve. Keep it clean. If this dog issue is a big issue with you, you don't approve the plan. That would be my preference when we go to vote on this. So I'm just telling you, I don't want to get into a big dog debate. And I don't care if you like dogs or don't like dogs. You like the plan or don't you? So, any other comments?
I do have one more question, actually. I thought there was a line I was just searching for it here in the plan, something about that there had been an increase in, for example, E. coli or some markers of what could be attached to kind of dog and activity perhaps in the watershed, or did that show up? Do you recall if that shows up in any of the water?
It's not something that's sampled for. The reservoir is too big. It's not something that's looked at in particular like that. So there's no direct link. There's nothing in this that says E. coli has increased, so we need to prohibit dogs. There's nothing at all like that. The question was asked by the public, and you might have seen it in a public comment and response, either on the website or in the comments in the appendices.
Yeah. Okay.
Dog feces cause E. coli any more than a year
or it has happened in the Jefferson County watershed where it's been shut down because of E. coli.
Yeah.
And I did read that in newspaper articles and things about this process, but you know, my memory is it's been a couple of years, but that is something that occurred and it was because of the E. coli and But that study was not done. That's not part of the data of this plan. That has nothing to do with our plan, our watershed, the result that we're presenting here. So I'm not to be confused. That was a newspaper article that I read. It's not included in this plan.
Yeah, I mean, I think in general, like ruminants and things that don't, for example, you know, herbivores and things, just have just generally lower kind of all pathogen counts within their guts and feces, et cetera. Dogs, of course,
it depends on exactly what they eat, but ultimately they're
E. coli more omnivorous. You can think of them as them. Yeah, so they do wind up.
Because I do know that wildlife feces can cause like Giardia soros. Stream water, no matter how clear it was. I didn't know if like dog feces could really cause E. coli more than anything else.
Okay, Daniel, thank you for your presentation. I guess I will ask, is there a motion from anybody to accept this plan? Is there a second? Okay. Move and second. Yes, you can make a comment.
Thank you. In making the motion, I'd like to explain kind of why I'm using it. From my perspective, perspective, I think that healthy watershed is one of those biodiverse. I don't know about the feces in the water, but I do think that there's pretty evident link between wildlife and dogs and how that's just natural processes. So I would support all the recommendations for that reason and respect your recommendation as well, because you guys are professionals who do this on a daily basis. So thank you very much for all the work that goes into it and the amazing pictures as always.
Okay. The motion been made and seconded?
I missed it, I'm sorry.
The
motion and the second?
Motion and second by Kevin.
No, Renee.
One, sir.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, let's vote. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. No opposed?
Alright, thank you.
So we don't know who likes dogs or not, but we're moving forward. But I think I get the message. You know, I think it's very important, but we do what we can up there. So, thanks again for your work on this and your presentation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Okay. Heather, you doing a...
Ken's good.
Just real quickly, there were a few bills that are sort of water related, listed in your packet. We really haven't been tracking, water legislative bills much this year. There really isn't much like normal. The standard CWCV projects bill is in there and, along with the naming projects on it, so most of them pass anyway. But we recommend it. So we don't have any bills that we're asking for recommendation. Just a few we're tracking. Actually, from our part, it's been a pretty quiet session.
That's good.
It's good.
Yeah. All right.
That's all we have.
Okay, Wes.
Monthly water supply updates. So, for that time of year, we probably pay a slight bit closer attention to what's going on. So, we've included in the packet some different stuff. First thing we've included is the Colorado Water Supply Outlook Report that comes out each beginning of each month. And so, they'll be updating that. Actually here probably within about a week, but so we included that. What we really look at that primarily is Colorado headwaters in the South Platte Basin. And so at the very end of that, I've included a couple graphs. First being this, the one for the Colorado headwaters. And as of today, snowwater equivalent was at about 121%, and so today we were at about a little over 15 inches of snowwater, and the peak is usually about 16 inches, and that peak is normally hit on April 7th. So we're pretty good. We're in good shape for that Colorado, and then for the South Platte, we're likewise in pretty good shape, maybe not quite as good relative to the Colorado headwaters. Today we were at 107% on the South Platte, and so that was representing about 11 inches with the peak at about 15 inches that we find on the 26th of April. So usually we hit the peak earlier on the Colorado River than we do the South Platte Basin. But both of which are above normal. And then lastly, I think I included one for the St. Vrain Basin. And for the St. Vrain Basin, keep in mind that really reflects like one snowtell site. I'm kind of on page 36, I don't know if you want to jump up there. But the St. Vrain Basin today was at a 121% of average, but we're actually higher today than we would have normally found ourselves at the peak. So what we'd like to see is see that peak grow or sustain as time moves on, so then that means we're going to get have a better runoff. And then the last thing we've included was a U.S. drought monitor for Colorado. And I guess what I wanted to, that's the following page. And what I wanted to kind of highlight there was, when we look at last year, a year ago on this date, 100% of the state was in an abnormally dry condition or worse. This year, a little over 50% was in that abnormally dry or worse condition, and just about 45% had no drought. So the general message is we're much better this year than we were last year, which we're all thankful for. So
yeah, it's definitely a lot less colorful.
Yeah, which is right, and that's what we'd like to see on this map. So so that's kind of where we're at. And that was the only additional thing I wanted to bring to your attention, other than what Kevin's already mentioned to the water supply status report.
Yeah. It's favorable.
Yeah.
No question about it.
We're in good shape, but we really are, as always, looking for those spring storms. Those will help us with that peak runoff, which is going to be really important to have for storage.
Any questions? Jason.
So for engineering updates, we're wrapping up the one big one I wanted to bring up to you is we're wrapping up that the Upper North St. Drain Pipeline alignment study. We had actually tried to schedule Dewberry to come in and give you a presentation today, but we didn't want to cut short Daniel's presentation time, and we want a little bit more time to study and prepare our slides. So we're going to try to bring that to you in next month's So we'll have Dewberry come, we'll have Schnabel come as well. And so try to do kind of what she did, give you a big presentation and any questions you have and stuff. We'll have our consultants and staff on board to answer those questions.
Right.
But we wanted to kind of run that through you guys first before we show that to city leadership.
All right. That's a good idea.
That's the one big
update
I had for you.
That's it?
That's it.
All right. Can you want to talk about that again?
Yeah, we're still, project's still moving forward, even though we had some pretty cold weather this winter. There were a number of weather days, but by and large, because they're in, I'll call it the rock quarry portion of the project, they kept the rock quarry going. That's one of the real big time sensitive issues is basically green rock for the rock fill dam. And of course the outlet tunnel, the end tunnel, continued on, and they're working from both sides of both portals now, so that is going well. The other part of the project is the Colorado River Connectivity Channel on the west slope. And of course that, because you're up at Granby elevation, that has shut down for the winter. They're hoping to get going in March, towards the end of March, depending on the weather up there. Little more low snow up there than normal, so it might delay a lot, maybe a week or so, but they're still planning on getting back into construction. We've actually, as of last fall, they had turned the dam and remember, they're going to take half of the reservoir out, turn the main dam, build a new dam, and for the Colorado River would now flow. And that dam is up, it was up high enough to be made so it was safe for spring runoff. They would like to get it about 1 to 2 foot higher before the spring runoff, so that's why they're anxiously waiting to get back in, start working. But waiting for a thaw over on the west slope. And the last thing I wanted to do was play show and tell today. So I've got, I don't know if you'd call it a heavyweight coaster or
dangerous to me.
Paperweight or whatever. This is actually a core from the hydraulic asphalt core of the dam. the first placement was in October, and it's about 40 foot long now, and continue on from there. I wanted to let you see, I always try myself to say hydraulic asphalt core rather than just asphalt core, because when you say asphalt core, people think of a street and gosh, don't they crack, right? This is the typical asphalt from a street, actually from a Walnut Street. If you look at that core, this is the actual asphalt core from the dam. If you look, the hydraulic asphalt is about twice the content of asphalt that a regular asphalt you would have on a street. So you can just, but visually, it's also smaller grained. Nice. The reason the additional asphalt is to make it more viable and really self-heating. When you get the weight of the dam on top of the weight of all the everything else on top of it, you can, even if say there were an earthquake or something, it would have potential to self-heal. Also makes a much better water stop. And of course, being in the dam, it's not heavy. Yeah. So anyway, just wanted to let you see what the actual hydraulic asphalt.
And you know, that solidifies pretty significantly. Yeah. I thought of asphalt dam, I thought, you know, is that really going to be
squishy?
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Yeah, no,
quite solid, so.
Yeah, it'll be pretty solid. So anyway, right now we're going to go on.
So they, it sounds like they had backed off get the winter behind them or the weather behind them or
on the west
slowly, yeah.
And then here on this side they've been working year round.
And they can
be able to stop. So.
It must be what civil engineers do is make take away out of dam course. I have a bunch of old dam course that have been made into a book.
Bookends.
There you go. Yeah. Because my dad said that. Well, when they get bored in the mill, that's what they do. So.
Okay.
That is true.
It's your creative outlet, I guess.
Jeremy Hollow was really a source of chopsticks. I mean, you know, we got all kinds of toys. We got the shovel and the groundbreaking golden shovel, wooden jar of rock, all kinds of stuff.
Nice mug. Yeah, I'm using the mug.
Yeah,
stuff.
Yeah.
All right, 9E.
Water rights filing update. Just wanted to update the water board on two water rights filings. You may recall in December of 2021, we came to the water board for a recommendation to file a new water right. The same Green Creek, basically straight north of here. That was what we're calling the same Green Creek filing, 20 CFS filing. It was really partially in conjunction with the change case on the bonus ditch, but it also gives us downstream water to meet downstream obligations and included a water right. Water in the St. Mary Creek pump station up at the Union Reservoir. So kind of a downstream waterway. We filed that in December of 21. We had four statements of opposition. We just settled with the last opposer. So that case now we'll be putting together the final decree to submit to water court. And we should, with no opposition, we should have final decree in the next couple, 2 to 3 months. So we're happy with that. That was successful. The other water right was a change of the bonus ditch. The bonus ditch diverts out just east of Main Street on the St. Green Creek. Goes out and generally irrigates property east of Longmont, east of Costco. Actually irrigated the property Costco is on now. Goes all the way out to Sandstone Ranch and irrigates some city open space out. Also Boulder County open space. We own 56% of that company, primarily the water we got off of Costco.
we took that into water court, filed that case in 2020. Got a number of opposers. One of huge note to us was Aurora. First time we ever had an opposition from the city of Aurora. We've now essentially settled with everybody. We don't actually have a statement of opposition signed with the ditch company itself. We're doing an operations agreement. That's done. They've indicated everything's fine, but the president of the company's the president who was a Boulder County employee retired and had to take 2 months off, and then we'll be back in 2 months. So he's the president of the company. So when he gets back, which is in March, we'll sign the final documents on that and have that change case ready to submit for a final decree as well. So we're happy two major cases through moving forward. So. Good news.
Good deal. All right. Can you want to talk about the major project listing at all? Or?
I don't have, I'll let Wes cover if there's anything more.
All I wanted to mention, we continue to track some of those things. We did talk today about the water supply. Upcoming in April, we'll be bringing the water supply route, adding the plan, and then next month, the cash in lieu review. But on the other topics, one of the questions was asked last year about remaining historic water rights and water rights deficits within the LPA. And so we kind of worked with our GIS folks, and I just wanted to give you just a real high level report on that. So roughly speaking, there's about 4,000 acre feet of outstanding raw water deficits within the LPA. And of that, about half would be satisfied through the transfer of historic water rights. And so the remainder would be non-historic. And of that, roughly 2,000-ish acre feet. We're estimating somewhere between 1,000 and 1,500 would be realistically expected to be satisfied with cash. So that's just kind of
the last part again.
Of the 2,000 acre feet that would be needed to be satisfied as either non-historic or cash in lieu, we're anticipating half to three quarters of that would be satisfied vis-a-vis cash in lieu. So just wanted to get back to answering your questions that you guys had on that.
Okay. All right. Any other comments?
Really dumb question. What is LPH?
Well, my planning area.
Okay.
LPA. If I said LPA, we were both thinking about
what would be the other one. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Or you maybe wanted to go out to lunch and ride across from Walnut High. I think
LPA. You know, I was looking at the status report, the Union Reservoir and Enlargement Acquisition Program. We approved it. Assume council did too. Is that kind of moving along, or is it a standstill? What's going on there?
So 25 years ago, we acquired the property around Union Reservoir. Once a year or so, we just bring an update to Water Board. Most recently, our last update was when we purchased a parcel property on the west side of the reservoir, on the Kelleher Estate. There is one more parcel on the west side that we need to acquire that we're currently negotiating with, and we believe we'll have that information probably in March or April, probably closer to April, I guess. And we'll update for it in April when that parcel comes forward.
Assuming that that parcel is acquired, the work for the expansion is not funded on the comprehensive plan, is it?
It is not, no.
What is the comprehensive plan doing, Mark?
It's me.
You're the source, Marcia.
Well, they haven't brought up a new one yet for quite a while, so.
You think it's?
Yeah, they're supposed to be working on some revisions to Envision, and there's so many land use zoning conflicts that what they're looking at is to like have bifurcate the code. So essentially there's one set of land use and building codes for the old suburban style zoning and one set of land use and building codes for the urban rules. And so I'm not sure what's going to happen with that. I bet it's going to be exciting, actually. Because there are a lot of people who don't want the rules to change.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Okay, I guess there's nothing. Item 11, no informational items?
No, those are only in your packet.
Okay. Cash in lieu, we're looking at that next month, right? Okay. Part of our packet, Ken, maybe you can talk to this. I don't know what you want to say, but a copy of the letter, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation on.
That was an email that was sent out, so he sent that information at the time. That's just the informational items that were attached in the packet.
Okay. So, it appears that this whole issue is just kind of continues to be in a state of flux on how we're going to resolve all this.
It is very much so, yes. Yeah. And there's a lot of national politics going on.
Yeah.
Does the consideration of, let me phrase this right, do the national politics and this kind of national discussion about the broader kind of Western issue, especially around Colorado River, that impacts us solely through our investment in CBT and then also Wind Gap, of course, or Wind Gap. Are there any other, there's really no other linkages really between us and that broader discussion?
Yeah, there wouldn't be in terms of our native base.
Yeah.
St. Rick Creek. It's huge when you think of CBT.
Right. And any kind of deficits or adjustments that have to be made to the operation of CBT, do you feel like that's going to get spread evenly amongst the stakeholders, or do we somehow have priority because we got in so early, or what are the stipulations in like our kind of association with that project?
Well, the CBT water is pretty well allocated for some tier or units. If there were, if it reduces any amount of water in storage, then our allocation.
And that's there's a formal process in place for that. It just means that each share is worth a lesser amount of acre foot, which is already every year they adjust that number. And so we already have a process in place for that. And so theoretically, it's just perennially we would be allocated less water for every share, such that we are in kind of like dry or drought years today. But that's the new norm if that were to become a thing later or kind of moving forward.
Chances are, the first things that would happen is I would suspect the carryover program would be eliminated. Certainly, there would be no regional pool. So the water that's in the system would start trickling down, strictly to be used on a year-to-year basis to all lotties. That would probably be enough. But understanding that future climate and future yield are unknown. I've said for years,
Colorado is well behind, is well below its 100. What would have to happen, essentially, before it would impact us, would be a major shift in the law of the river.
Yeah.
Lower Basin overuses, way overuses its allotment on the river. The Upper Basin way under. Yeah, there's a lot of politics there.
Yeah.
Huge. That's but you know.
Yeah. So assuming we go to war with California.
Yeah.
seriously. So what I'm probably the only person here who doesn't know this, but percentage of Longmont's usage, there's CBT water versus there's, you know, our native basin water. Where how's that breakdown?
So our all of our water rights planning and our guiding water principles and everything we've kind of set up, our plan is for 2/3 native basin water and 1/3 transbasin water. I think that's a good mix. It diversifies our portfolio and allows pressures us to make sure we use our native basin water first. You know, we've actually used our actual use. It's probably closer to half and half, maybe even a tiny bit more West Hope, just because we have excess supplies of both. And so it's a tiny bit easier to use the West Hope water, our water treatment plants. So because of that. Use has been a little bit more transbasin. Long term, if all of this, you know, becomes an issue, only 1/3 of our water, a future water supply,
would be impacted. Right. So of course, if it stops raining on the eastern slope, we're still
screwed. Then yes, climate. That part of it is. It is certainly our junior water rights, Button Rock storage, some of those get more impacted. Our senior water rights, you know, because of first in time, first in right, our senior water rights won't be affected. Our junior water rights will get called out completely.
Any other comments on agendas? Going forward, yes.
I have a request for a presentation. The Longmont, or sorry, State Brain Lifting Water Conservancy District is doing all the stuff on PL 566 and
yes.
Made some big strides. I was just hoping we could get them.
Yes, excellent point. I'll ask Sean if you can
Can you
show
that one for
me? State Brain Left-Hand Water Conservancy District is the watershed group.
Yeah.
This area includes Longmont River.
What's PL, whatever?
PL 566 is a law that enables people to get lots of money for water projects.
Right.
Yeah. It's through the SOCA, Natural Resources Conservation Service. Right. The district's person.
Anybody else?
I just one question. I don't know if this leads to a presentation or if it's just for our own kind of education at the moment, but the projections that, so I mean, there's a lot of work that's done in the Colorado Basin in terms of projections of impact of climate, future climate, et cetera. What do we use as our kind of base resource for projections on the East Slope for changes in hydrology due to future climate?
So it's actually been a little while ago, but a while back, all of the Front Range municipalities went together with the American Water Works Association Research Foundation and did what we call the Front Range Climate Change Vulnerability Study. And that study, and we used the biggest names in the climate industry, Brad Udall. Hans Kostner is
CPCU, CU is prevalent. And a number, I mean, a number of others have prepared a report to look at the future climate and what it will impact. We then use those numbers as input to our own future water demand evaluation. And then out of that, we came up with, we looked at how that would impact water rights in the St. Bay Basin, and which water rights and how much, how far down a tree that hurts us. And that's how we came up with a number. We have a number for future water demand impact or other future water availability based upon climate.
Yeah, I was gonna say, so does that include then future water supply? So in other words, so you said future water demand, but included in this assessment then is how much supply is actually in
the it looked at both what's a hotter, drier climate increase. So we looked at the increase in usage of the dam.
Okay.
And then how does it impact our lower supply?
Yeah.
How does it impact our supply? We look at how it would impact different water rights and how much. So it's really, you increase demand a little bit, you decrease supply a little bit, and that's the impact.
Right.
And we model that as a demand, you know, as a variability, we call them that.
Okay.
Future water demand variabilities. And so that's a count of that.
Is that publicly available?
Yep, it's on our website.
Yeah.
We'd be happy to come back sometime with a presentation on that.
I guess that's how that feeds into this discussion. Was just, you know, at some point, when it looks like we have a little time, I'd be interested to see.
Yeah, I would be happy.
It's not necessarily a priority.
They
would
do that on 2019.
One question before we close that I've got. I was looking over some information on our water board annual report. Do we do that annually? Are you working on it?
It'll be coming to you next month.
Okay.
So yeah, that's one of the things you, one of your charges, one of your requirements is to produce that to the city council.
All right. Okay. Is there a motion to adjourn?
So many.
I'll get some tea.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
All right. We're adjourned.
Yeah.